So today I'm going to be presenting some thoughts on biblical entrepreneurship. And this is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. It's something that I've kind of grown up with and something that I think we can examine from a biblical perspective and start to draw some parallels. So you see, this is like the general outline and mine is a lot more detailed, and we're gonna make it through this thing. So I'm going to be taking a tough look at a tough subject from a Christian perspective, because the world has a lot to say about what counts as being entrepreneurial. I told Charlie yesterday, I almost wish that this was after the family economy talk so I could steal some points from them, because I'm sure they're going to have some really good ideas on how family economies are built. And I'm like, oh, I could have worked that into biblical entrepreneurship, and then we could talk about a business with the family. I'm sure we will all be saying close to the same thing, because we hold to a biblical perspective on what work is, why we do work, why it's important, and what it means and how it impacts what we do. So on that note, this talk, I want to kind of clarify a few things in case there's any misconceptions. What this talk is not, this talk is not a 10 steps to a Bible-based business plan. So, I mean, you can forget any checklists. I'm not going to come up with a list of things that you can do to create a Bible-based business plan or anything like that. It's not going to be like modern portraits of businesses from the Old Testament. It's great for seeing what God did and how people used what he gave them to do, but I don't really believe that we need to drag those forward in today and to try and modernize the exact, like use it as a blueprint and a replica. I mean, times change, folks. So we can draw from them, but I'm not going to try and like bring that into the future and be like, now if you plant your field and you go over here and you do this thing, and this is actually all about computers. And no. This isn't ways that you and your family can start making money like as soon as you get home. So it's not a, there's no magic beans I'm passing out, even though we are going low tech. There's no great business idea that is going to just come out of all of this that you'll go home and go, ah, I can start making money from that. I mean, maybe, but it's not the point of the talk. And finally, the talk is not about trying to sell you on some kind of multi-level marketing or do-it-yourself millionaire model. If you want, I have my computer here. I could Google that for you, but because there are tons of things like that out there, and I don't think they're worth our pursuit or our time, because they're not ultimately what we're trying to achieve anyway. And I don't, on a side note, I don't think, you know, my dad always used to say, like, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. I don't believe that any get-rich-quick plan lines up with a biblical understanding of work. And so if anything seems like you could do a little bit of effort and get a lot of profit, there's a big difference between, like, calculating your efforts and having a high yield and then doing nothing and getting everything. So 90-plus percent of the time, those aren't sustainable or reliable. So I'm not going to talk about those. So instead, I want to develop an appreciation for work. I want to take a closer look at entrepreneurship in the Bible, set a realistic target for our efforts, learn to problem solve and to use what we already have instead of feeling like we need to reinvent the wheel each time. And then this is, frankly, my attempt to scratch an itch, to give you the key points that I would have wanted a long time ago when learning about what the Bible says about work and business. So I don't know if you've succeeded or failed or what you've done as far as work is concerned, but perhaps this talk will provide some new perspectives, and we can grow through it together. So on another note, why am I standing up here talking to you about this? Partially because I was asked, but partially because I have this, what I'm calling an achievement list of qualifying failures for why I could talk to you about the Bible and about work. Brandon's laughing already. So I grew up with a dad who loved entrepreneurship. I mean, he grew up with his dad who grew up with a buy low, sell high core thing. I mean, my dad would go somewhere and find something, buy it, and then turn it around and sell it and have more money so he could actually go buy it again if he wanted and still have money left over. And there was a lot of that in our home. From early on, he ingrained that stuff into us. So that helps. Does anybody remember garage sales, like where you put stuff out on your yard and people would like walk by or drive by and buy things? So when we were little, we had orange juice and donut holes that we would sell at our garage sales. So we'd do the garage sale. Our neighborhood was a big garage sale neighborhood. And my brother and I had this little business where at first he was kind of like the runner. You know, he would go get refills and stuff because we didn't let him handle money. After a while, it kind of became a business of ours. We would sit at the end of the, you know, we had to learn about product placement and things like that. You know, put us at the end of the driveway so that we could see. And then our parents would remind us that they're coming for the garage sale, not for the donut holes. But we would sell these donut holes and this orange juice for like 25 cents. It was a long time ago. So like 25 cents, we would sell, you know, the adults would help us fund it. They were kind of our investors. And so we learned about, you know, buying an inventory. And we'd be like, okay, we need to go. We're running out of donut holes. And they're like, well, there's people here buying the rest of our stuff. So we're going to, you just keep selling what you have, you know. And so those were great lessons. And we loved the process of trying to come up with a way to create a compelling presentation and everything with orange juice and donut holes. I mean, that was just like, it was so much fun. So then, that was in the morning. In the afternoon, once it hit like 11, 12 o'clock, we started selling lemonade and Oreos. I kid you not. I don't think I've ever eaten an Oreo with lemonade in my entire life, but we thought that people would want one or the other. You know, because everybody wants either lemonade or Oreos. So surely they'd want one or the other. So same model, you know, product placement, everything else. You couldn't let the lemonade get warm. You couldn't let the Oreos melt. So you had to come up with a way to, you know. I mean, we were like six. I mean, come on. So then we would always go to this ham radio conference up in Dayton, Ohio every year. And we started selling camouflage from the DRMO auctions on base. And so we would go to these auctions, we would buy bulk camo, and then we would sell it and, you know, piece it out and everything. And you had to learn, like, what pieces were good and what was worth a certain value and everything. You could go around to other tables and see what they were selling stuff for. And so then one year, we decided we were going to sell soda with, you know, because it was a hot day, we're going to sell soda with our camo and stuff. And it was great, except the fact that we didn't know you weren't allowed to have food sales. And so we're selling, and this guy drives by, and he kind of stops and backs up, and we're like, hey, cool, he's going to buy some camo. And he's like, and he just walks up and just very quickly tells us that we are not to have food sales. And so we were kind of crushed, because that was kind of a big part of our business model that year. And it was really funny because if my dad listens to this, I'm going to kind of blame this on him, because we decided what we would do is see if they would mind if we said a soda was free with a qualifying purchase. Well, the guy drove by again, and it didn't go well. We actually almost lost our space in the flea market. But it was really close. He was not a happy man. And we're like, we're just trying to sell stuff here. You know, come on. So that was interesting. And then I found the internet. And I realized that I could make honest wages by creating products, digital products. This still blows my mind. You create something that isn't real, and you sell it to people you've never met over something you can't touch, and then you get money. Like, it just, I still don't get it, but I figured it out. I was like, okay, cool. So I started making digital products and selling them and bundling photos and selling them stuff. And that was pretty cool. You know, that's honest work. Well, I also realized that I was really, really good at finding things on the internet, and I could find things that were a lot of money and buy low, or in this case, steal, and then sell high by, like, turning the product around and selling it. And to my credit, I only did this once, and then my conscience caught up to me. But I did actually, at one point, as I'm implicating myself on air, that I actually did sell a pirated product once, because I thought it was like the coolest mechanic ever. You know, I could take something, and so that's a dishonest gain example. But it contributes toward why I believe a biblical understanding of biblical entrepreneurship is a big deal. So then I moved in to a townhome with Jonathan and Brandon and sort of took on a self-employment bent. That was really neat because it taught me how to negotiate a fair wage, taught me the value of time. It kind of gave me a taste for the future, which led to working for my dad's company a couple times, creating multiple positions, working for a college, for a church, you know, little things here and there. But I found out it was a lot of created positions. They weren't things where they said, we want X, and then I came in and provided Y, and we all reached Z. It was very much like there was always like this, okay, well, I can also do these things. And they said, oh, okay, you know. And so even there was a little bit of an entrepreneurial bent. So then we moved to Springfield, Missouri, and Brandon and I started a company. We actually have an LLC, started the company, and started doing these videos about friends and business. And our goal was we were going to debunk the myth of why friends couldn't be in business together, because that's what everybody said. If you're a friend, you shouldn't go into business together. It doesn't work, whatever. And we're like, yeah, whatever. And so we decided we were going to start a business together and prove to everybody why you could do this. You could ask his wife, Kari, if that worked or not. We had a lot of back and forth of trying things and exploring options and stuff like that. We did do some business, but ultimately we ended up going different ways and moving on to new stuff. So then, after kind of a crummy jobby job that I had, I took on a self-employment role again in Springfield. And, you know, at this job, I had kind of finished all the work they told me to do, and they basically said, well, you're done with everything, so bye. I was like, well, I guess I'm self-employed. And so I went home and started doing this. And I didn't realize this at the time, but it was actually, I guess, my job to redefine starving artist. And I was so good at it. I mean, I was so good at, you know, making so little money that I wasn't sure where rent was coming from. And so I thought that was maybe like a calling. And so I just, you know, but it was a real trying time because, again, the value of time, negotiating prices, you know, well, if I spend 5 hours doing this and I get paid for 1 hour, and my dad is on the phone with me several times going, you know, are you like, how are you charging for your time? And stuff like, well, you know, I'm doing this. He's like, so how are you paying for your bills? And, you know, I mean, just so many life lessons, again, talking to my father about this. And so then you have today. Today, I've had a lot of hobbies that have turned into products and service ideas and different things like that, and I will continue because it's ingrained in me. It's been there from the very start. So that was a lot of years of trying, failing, succeeding, learning. But at the end, I'll come back and show you how those actually taught me and brought me here, and taught me about what the Bible says about entrepreneurship. My father taught me a lot of these points by example, and I wanted to share a top-down biblical perspective of entrepreneurship. So I want to talk to you about wrong biblical reflections. Work is hard. It always has been. Remember, it wasn't the fall that brought about work, but God's mission to Adam and then Eve in the garden. Genesis 2:15 says they were put in the garden to cultivate and to keep it. This is before the fall. This is before sin enters the world. Work is a good thing. It's a blessing. It has always been hard, but then after the fall, you got toil. They were cursed with painful toil, and to achieve the same results as before, they now had to hurt. They were toiling against the earth. But the mission, though, it didn't change. And even after God washed the earth clean with the flood, his mandate to Noah was the same in Genesis 8. Go out, populate it, take it, keep it. And I think it's crucial to remember that our skill sets and your mission are both from God. And so everything we do here is about his glory, not the businesses that we engage in. I mean, the very first command given to man is what? It's in Genesis 1:28. And it says, God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky, over every living thing that moves on the earth. The very first thing God tells man to do is to fill and populate and to take care of this place. So how well do you recall some of the workers and businesses in the Bible? This was interesting as I was considering this topic of biblical entrepreneurship. Because I think a lot of times we frown, as Christians, we frown over making a profit. Sometimes it's easy somehow to believe that we ought to do with as little as possible and to just trust God for every dollar. But, I mean, yeah, but we should be trusting God for every breath. So let's, I mean, we don't need to go there. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make money or build things or prosper in any way. But there's almost like this increased level of holiness that we get sometimes when we feel like if we make money, then it's a terrible thing. And so we should only thank God for our daily bread and do the George Mueller thing. And like, you know, I mean, that's kind of it. That's out there. And I've hit that a lot as I've tried to figure out what work is according to the Bible. But I believe that guilt for worldly gain is a trap almost as deadly as depending on the world and not God for your increase. I think it's almost just as bad that we would go to God and say, well, if you bless my efforts, then I may not love you anymore, so don't bless my efforts, just give me enough for my daily bread. And that's, to me, that's almost as bad as saying, well, I'm going to work and then maybe God will do something about it later. So I have some biblical examples of entrepreneurial workers. And I'm going to kind of plow through these. They're not on this other display. But I want you to recall some of the things that we know about this and then try and figure out how this correlates into businesses today. So obviously, I have to start with the parable of the talents. I mean, it's a classic example of initiative among employees. And again, it's a lesson for increase, too, that the master doesn't chide the one who returned 100-fold, but he does say to the one who returned the one because he didn't use it that he was displeased. And so I think we learn stewardship through things like that. How about Balaam, a man with special gifts from God who sold out his people for increase? He sold out the nation of Israel so that he could have increase and clout with these other nations. But he was clearly using this gift or a word that God had given him, and he used it for dishonest gain. Likewise, Ananias and Sapphira. That's a negative example because we get people who gained rightly. They were just doing business. And frankly, they were being entrepreneurial because they were selling their land and they were taking stuff that they owned and then turning a profit. But they attributed it falsely. They didn't do what they were supposed to do and turn it back to God. I think the contrast, and one of the best pictures of business in the Bible, is Boaz. Perhaps the exact opposite of Balaam. This is a man who worked hard with what he had. He was a self-employed delegator, which is really, really tough to find. It's hard to find someone who not only can run their own business, but then also can delegate to employees. And we know that he was a man of God, and his employees respected him and even returned when he said, "The Lord be with you," and they would say, "And also with you." I mean, he had an incredible relationship with his employees. Joseph and Daniel, slaves to earthly masters, caretakers of those without means. They fed the poor. They did everything they could with the skills and the gain that their masters had. And these were men whose faithfulness ultimately honored God. Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a project manager with a line of credit from the king. I mean, just a fantastic story packed into really even just the first couple chapters of Nehemiah chronicle this guy's story. And it's so, if you've never read through it and thought about it from a business perspective, I encourage you to, because he does such a good job of recognizing a problem, going to the king, appropriating resources, which required a good relationship with his master, by the way, and then going and doing something, managing people, calling on more resources when he needed them, appropriating them properly, not taking it for his own gain. I mean, just, he's an excellent, excellent example. How about the apostles in the New Testament? Paul, Matthew, Luke, these were all bivocational workers who, both before and after Christ walked on the earth, they all had trades and things that they did. And this is a really interesting thing, is if you think about the apostles as people who applied skills that they had when the field of work changed, because they knew certain things about their lives before Christ and they had been working. And then after Christ, they had a different calling, but some of them continued to do some of that work. And so their way they applied those skills had to change. But we get hints of how they continued to do this work because they were providing. Solomon used his trade with the nations and the people within them to further the kingdom. There is an incredible history of the nation's drastic increase when Solomon becomes king. And he's buying things, and he's building things, and he's doing all this stuff. And you can see him managing resources and working with other nations and all this stuff. Got like an international trade. Timothy and Titus were workers for the church. Their stories are, and you can hear how Paul especially appreciates both of these men, and how he regards the way they work and the dedication they have to serving the church in a very high regard. Going back to the Old Testament, how about Abraham, who split a nation wisely and honorably? He didn't take the biggest portion first. He wanted to be at peace with Lot, and so when it came time when they said, "We're getting too big, the land can't support us," they came together and he said, "Take your pick." Lot said, "That looks really good, I'll take that part." Abraham said, "Okay, I'll go this way," and then God stopped him in his tracks and said, "See everything in front of you, I'm going to give all of it to you." And I think, I really do think that we have a picture of wise and honorable faithfulness and humility before God in Abraham. And I think we can learn from that in business. And finally, Bezalel and Aholiab. If you don't know who Bezalel and Aholiab are, you need to go back and read about these guys, because these are the ones who were divinely appointed to construct the first tabernacle. And Bezalel is one of my favorite examples of work, and has been such an encouragement to me over the years. I love reading about this guy because there's so little about him. But he's a craftsman. He was a master craftsman, and God pointed his name out to Moses and said, "This is the person that I have appointed to build the tabernacle." So I think we have a clear example of doing what we know how to do, what God has given us to do, and then if he wishes, he'll exalt us to a point of doing something great, like, you know, he was called to build the tabernacle. But that's, I think the bigger picture there is that in order for him to be good enough to do those things, because he pretty much takes the blueprints from Moses and starts, which means he was already a master craftsman. He'd already been applying his trade. If that's the case, then he's already been working with those skills and the things that God has given him to do for a very, very long time. And who knows what he was doing? He could have been just like making tables and stuff. But the point is he had a history of good work behind him. And then if God does this, great. If not, that's okay too. You can honor him through humble work. But when God called on him to do this great work, he was ready because he had developed his trade and his craft. And that is especially convicting to me. Because if we look around and consider the mandate that he's given to us, I mean, I don't see how we can be afraid of gain if the goal is to populate, to fill, to keep, to mind the earth. I don't see how we can be afraid of gain in that way, because really what he's telling us to do is to increase and to increase his name and his presence throughout the earth. All of these people that were the good examples were exhorted to work because they were to succeed. So my question to you is, would God command dominion but then punish us for the success of that command? I don't believe that's the case. I think that takes us to observable integrity and truth, ways that we can show the integrity and the truth we have in us as we work. So I have a challenge for all of you while I'm talking. Come up with a business that has nothing to do with witnessing, telling Bible stories, or using God's name in the title. Because it's really easy to get caught up in, okay, if I want to have a business and I'm a Christian, then it seems like I would need to stitch scripture into quilts or something like that. And that's fine, and it's a great thing. But you don't have to do something that explicit to be an honorable picture of godly labor. And this is something that really tripped me up, because I was looking at biblical entrepreneurship when I was sitting in my apartment saying, well, I guess I'm self-employed because my job just went away and I know how to do some computer stuff, so I'll start doing that. Is like I started saying, okay, well, how could I use this as, you know, a mission thing, and how could I build websites for churches and all this stuff? And ultimately, it's how you're using your skills and how you're attributing those skills. But too often I see Christians who want to be successful, but they think they have to do something very explicit in order for it to count somehow. And I think that's a real trap. God gave all of us a mandate to tend this earth. And there's a difference between being a witness and standing on a soapbox. I heard a very worldly worker say this the other day. But I think it's a really good picture of how we envision our work. He said, people, you can either argue that corporations aren't people or that pointing out their bad practices is shaming. He says you can't do both. You can either treat a corporation like a person and try and hold them to some kind of moral standard, or you can hold them as a business entity that does things, and it's about the people inside them that are the accountable parts. I thought that was really interesting because we get really excited as Christians when companies like Chick-fil-A or Hobby Lobby or whomever speak out against evil or take a hard stand, you know, against all the news and all the fray and everything. But why do we get excited about that? If we believe that God needs these businesses or, you know, needs us to build a platform so that we, like, his name can be more known because of the bigger platform we've built, I mean, I think we're sorely mistaken. And frankly, his name doesn't need, and I heard a very wise pastor say one time, God doesn't need your name to get his name pushed up higher. He already has the name that's above every other name. He doesn't need yours to build on top of so that people can hear about that. So stop trying to build a platform for God. He's already at the top. You can't do it. But if we believe that, then I think it caused a lot of mispractice. So a lot of us have been looking in the 1689, and we've been looking at providence and God's decree and his sovereignty. And I believe that all of that demands our response. And we still have a base level responsibility to care for those in our charge, to be good stewards of the earth. And so I hope that we wouldn't ever take or create a business to hide behind the brand or to use it without reason or to do anything except to be a good steward of the hope we have. I don't think that casting that into the wind is being a good steward. And so if we were to say, well, I have this truth and the way I'm going to use it is by, I'm trying very hard not to mention some businesses in the Christian space that are doing this right now in our day, where they're taking the message that they have, they believe that is true from Scripture, and they're basically spamming the entire world at every opportunity, and they're just laying it out. And I'm trying so hard not to say their names, but they're populating the space with so much noise and so much misappropriation of what's actually going on and what's actually true that it's giving it a bad name. It's not increasing anything. And so I think if we were to just cast it to the wind, we're not guarding the truth. We're watering it down. But that said, everything we do has to be a witness. And everything we do is a testimony of what we believe, right? So the work we do is not always a platform for preaching, but remember that everything we do showcases what we believe. I mean, everything. You see someone do something, they are telling you what they believe by their actions. I am forever quoting Van Til when he said, culture is religion externalized. What you see people doing in a culture is what they believe. You know, in Daniel 2:14, it says that Daniel had discretion and discernment when he was talking to the king. And in 6:3, that he had an extraordinary spirit. And these were things that his worldly employers, his captors, noticed about him through his work. And it was visible to everyone around him. It was given to him by God, but he served without a lot of fanfare and hoopla of his own, at least from his side of things. I mean, 'cause, but even this, why was he noticed in what he did? Why do we get to look at Daniel and find something great? Because he was consistently, diligently, and resolutely seeking God. And yes, his goal was to get home, to no longer be enslaved with his captors. But he was known because they knew that these times of the day, he's going to be talking to God about what to do next. And I mean, he worked as unto the Lord in such a wide variety of situations. As kings came and went and nations rose and fell, he attributed his success to God at every turn, but not with a lot of pomp and circumstance. So even non-Christian businesses, that quote I read earlier, are advising us to do something because you want to help people. Or they don't, I mean, they're telling you the most important thing. I was just talking to Brandon last night about this business guy that we used to listen to, and all of them are saying, it's all about the people. It's all about your customers. It's all about helping. It's all about providing quality and everything else. Folks, these guys don't even have Christ to share with people, and they get that. They get that it's about the people that they're serving, not the product, not the business model. So I think we need to make sure that our efforts are worthwhile, honoring, and pleasing, because we do have Christ to share. And that should mandate that we use it a little more wisely and use our time wisely. So, let's see if I can scroll here. I'll give you a preview. No peeking. So, righteous time and attention. The root of the word entrepreneur is varied. I was disappointed to not find, like, one common definition. So it depends on your source. But the general thought behind the word entrepreneur is you have a non-fixed income earner. So people who buy low and sell higher something. You know what I mean? You don't really have a way to quantify what they're earning. Or maybe you have a shifting economic resource into an area of higher productivity. You have innovators using process to transform current products and services into new ones. It's a little more down to earth. Seekers of change, opportunity, and invention through close imitation. Interesting. Basically, this is someone who makes something more out of the something than what they started with. They take 2 + 2 and get 5. That's an entrepreneur. The whole world is trying to tell us who we should be and what we should be working on, caring about, or moving toward. But we have an ultimate guide for what God has said to be important. And he's given us some very clear commands about what he considers to be important. We don't need the status of what the world considers to be important. You've heard me give this list before, so I'll give you the short version. But some simple things God has told us to do: be fruitful, subdue the earth, regard others more important than yourselves, work with your hands quietly, exercise your gift, abhor evil, be devoted to one another, peace with all men, be subject to government. That's a tough one if you're an entrepreneur. Humbly release your anxiety, incline your ear to wisdom, practice righteousness, and finally, do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. So do these things match up with what we hear around us today as we examine entrepreneurship, especially from a worldly perspective? I mean, as an example, here's another worldly perspective that I heard. There's too much I want to say and do and see and feel and experiment with. There's a real joy in not knowing what you're doing, and there's a joy in amateurism. And that kind of struck me because, yes, while we should enjoy the journey, but the culture of entrepreneurship and startups in our day today is kind of like the adolescent stage that we expect our kids to go through. So there's a show out right now called Silicon Valley, and it's kind of a independent look at startups and kind of, you know, what a lot of people call like the second gold rush, when everyone went out to California and there were computers and they were building things, and it was kind of the push in that area. So this show is focused on hoodies and flying by the seat of our pants and emotional highs and the drama and the sex, drugs, rock and roll part of building a business. But the show is very popular. Even like among my coworkers who have regular, you know, jobby jobs, like, it's very popular because there's something hip about this process today. But why does our cultural our culture revel in not knowing what you're doing. I don't get that. Doesn't it kind of contradict the idea of consistent, carefully considered labor? Why is it such a big deal to all of us that we you don't know what you're doing, you have no clue, you don't have a business plan, you're not sure where you're going to get funding and everything else, and so that's desirable. It doesn't even make sense. I don't think it lines up. My argument for entrepreneurship is that it is a direct response to the dominion mandate. I think entrepreneurship is a perfect circumstance to act out the dominion mandate. You could say that entrepreneurship is a creative act made possible by the creative impulse that God has given us. If the purpose of our lives is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever, then how does work play into that goal? I mean, if we had a choice, how better could we achieve that goal than through a skillful application of gifts He has given you? And so I believe that dominion is best achieved through using whatever He has given our hands to do, and that we should do it with all our might. That's Ecclesiastes 9 and Colossians 3. But inevitably, as we go through entrepreneurial stuff, we feel like sometimes we know nothing. Because how do you know what skill sets to apply? I mean, you could do anything. I mean, there's so much that you could put your hands to. I'm going to try and kill two birds with one stone here, though. It's easy to be overwhelmed by the number of possibilities, because really, everybody can figure out how to mow a lawn. Everybody can figure out how, you know. But there are resources to learn just about anything you want, especially using online tools. You can learn anything between YouTube and a couple other things. I mean, it's free. It's free information. And I think we do need to make sure we do our diligence and put in the hours. Someone that Brandon and I used to listen to a lot said, if you're going to start a business, you need a business model. You know, I mean, and you hear that, you go, duh. And we did at the time. We're like, well, yeah. But, I mean, no, seriously, you need to have a plan for sustainability in your work if you expect it to succeed. You wouldn't build a house and not know what it's supposed to look like when it's done, right? I mean, come on. Another friend of mine wisely suggested that we focus on using what God has already given us versus reinventing the wheel each time. And I think that is a tough one, because the businesses that we could come up with are varied, and we feel like we have a lot we could do. And there's a time for innovation, but what can we do right now? Like, not what could we do if we had 10 extra, you know, tractors or 40 extra computers or 3 months with nothing else to do with our time. What can we do now? Because you probably never have those things. So don't depend on those until you get started. Don't focus on the perfect situation. Focus on the proper application of the gospel using what you already have today. Can you cook? Can you write? Can you clean? I mean, can you walk dogs? Like, what can you do today? Do that. Start with those things. How can you use your talents, your failures, and what God has already shown you through Scripture to bless those around you? Start there with biblical entrepreneurship. Get to the essence of what God has given you to work with, and then grow and learn those things. Don't be dissatisfied with what He's already given you to use. This is one of the biggest things that has tripped me up over the years, is I've become dissatisfied with something that He's given me and thought, well, I really need to find a really lofty way to do this and this and this, because this and this and this and this. And the whole time, He's given me skill sets and things to do, and I look past them because, like, oh, no, you know, I need to have a startup, and I need to have, you know, these things, and it needs to be. It's just, that's so antithetical to what we see in Scripture. I mean, and so then you get to ask questions about why you do what you do. Is it for money? Is it for recognition? Is it for happiness? None of those things are going to last. So have patience. Every single thing you do with what God has given you is better than zero. Every single thing. Build it slow. Put in the hours. Forget about entitlement. You're not entitled to anything. So put in the hours and build it slowly. Be concerned with how you'll look to the following generations, whether you can stand the test of time with those heroes of faith that we have in Hebrews 11 and other portions of Scripture. Ecclesiastes is one of my favorite books in the Bible, and partially because I have this love for kind of a tragedy tone sometimes, but I love Solomon's perspective because he did everything. He went to the end of it all, man, and he came back with these nuggets that, and he kind of chronicled his journey to the end of physical attainment. I mean, just he literally did everything. In Ecclesiastes 2, right at the end of the chapter, he's talking about how he had done everything. He then turned to these sort of metaphysical things. He started considering wisdom and folly and everything. You know, he's getting up into the real high, lofty stuff. And then he came back down because he said he hated life because he realized it was all vanity. So he started talking about the futility of labor. And right at the end, in verse 24, he says, "There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him?" And then a little bit later, he continues in chapter 3. He talks about God setting eternity in the heart of man and how that God has given us this desire to pursue things and to chase after the things that we can't fully grasp, and that he's put that in our hearts as a way to constantly be wondering and pondering who he is. But then he also contrasts and says that God has tested the son of man in verse 18 of chapter 3. "God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they have all the same breath, and there's nothing, and there's no advantage for man over a beast, for all is vanity. They all go to the same place. All came from dust, and all return to dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast ascends downward toward the earth? As I have seen that nothing is better than man should be happy with his activities, for that is his lot. Who will bring him to see what occurs after him?" And so he's contrasting what we do with our time on this earth with, and he even talks about multiple times in the book, he's like, "I built this up, and I don't know who's going to manage it after me. I don't know what's going to come after me. I don't know how this is going to be used. So why am I struggling just to see increase and to build things? If I don't, I'm not going to be around to enjoy it. I'm going to die just like the beast does, and someone else is going to have control of this." And so he comes back and forth to this idea of vanity. And that's a really hard thing to deal with when you're wanting to be an entrepreneur, because you realize no matter what you build or what you do, you're eventually amassing resources or wealth or success or whatever, and you can't take it with you. And so that's why I don't think it's good to have this idea of entrepreneurship or business in general that is all about what we've earned or it bringing us happiness or anything that is temporal on this earth. But I think that leads us to intentional entrepreneurship. And in Proverbs 16, verse 3, it reads, "Commit your works to the Lord and your plans will be established." A couple of verses later in verse 9, "The mind of the man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps." We have examples in Scripture, and we have one another in the wise counsel that we can seek to help us find what God considers worthy uses of our time and effort. So, but let me ask you this. What if all of our businesses were as charitable as Boaz? What if every single master managed resources like Solomon did? What if every slave, right now I'm a slave, I'm working for a third-party company. What if every slave were as commendable as Daniel or Joseph? What if each of us were to hone our abilities we had and let God exalt us like Bezalel and Oholiab did? I think if we're discontent with what God has given us to use, then we end up in a place that we don't recognize because he didn't design us to just use that for our own gain. Solomon went to the ends of human labor and got to the end and said, "It's vanity. It's all striving against the wind. And then someone else gets to maintain it when I'm gone." You know, he reached the end of it and said, "We're this vanity. Why do we do this?" But I think we have pictures in Scripture that teach us how to do it properly, because then we commit our work back to God and let Him bring the increase. So I promised coming full circle and telling you how my journey thus far has taught me a little bit about this biblical entrepreneurship through these different things over the years. So the garage sales taught me that the value of supply and demand, and, you know, we had to do inventory and then, like, report it to our dad or our grandfather or whatever, that taught me a little bit about doing business by selling donut holes and Oreos and lemonade. But it also taught me patience, because you had to sit there and wait for people. And you could rearrange everything on your table so many times, but then you learned when they showed up, it needed to be ready and you needed to be able to sell to them. And so that, you know, those little things add up. The soda and camouflage out in Dayton, Ohio, learning to buy low and sell high, and to obey the authorities put over us. That was a very poignant reminder. The online stuff, learning how to take something that I knew how to do and to make money from it, but then also learning about dishonest gain and just being incredibly convicted, you know, in having sold something that I didn't purchase. That was just, I will forever hold that. And I guess now tell the world about that. In the townhome, in the first kind of foray into self-employment, I learned to make something work without a plan, and how that's not a good way to run a business. It's not good to just say, well, I know how to do some computer stuff, and so I'm going to come over here, and I could do this computer stuff for you, and I don't really know how much it's going to be. You know, and that's kind of how I approached those first clients, and they're like, you don't have an hourly rate or anything. I mean, just, again, casting over the waters. I think that that's taking a skill set you have and just kind of flinging it and saying, well, I hope some of it grows and maybe I'll go be able to harvest it. That taught me a lot. Working with my dad or these created positions elsewhere was taught me to be willing to seek out new opportunities from within. So my dad had stuff that he needed done. My dad had things in his business that needed my skills, and I could apply them directly to that and help both of us. But if I wasn't willing to look at the opportunities there, if he wasn't willing to extend those to me, then I would have missed out on using something we already had and getting to work with my dad, frankly, which I will do anytime. Our first foray into business was making sure the direction you choose is sustainable. It was kind of a hard lesson and something that we joke about and everything, but the reality of the situation is that if you're going to begin applying a lot of effort to something, then you need to have a plan for how it's going to look when you're done. So, and then my own self-employment again, time is so precious. I tell you, that working for myself and not being sure when I, you know, what I could pay bills and things like that. Especially if you can't pay rent, you realize time is precious. But then even when things are going really great, I had one project that I earned more in 3 months than I did the previous 2 years. That was fantastic. But ultimately, it didn't stick because I didn't use the time that I had. By working that job, I could have set aside a whole month and done nothing and just built stuff, and I didn't. I kept doing these little things and getting ingrained in the process. That taught me time is precious. Today, hobbies trying to turn into products and services and things, right now that's teaching me a lot about focus, about how working on a small list of ideas versus trying to make all the things is not a good plan. You've got to focus on something, and not, you can't spread yourself too thin. I think all of us can attest to having spread ourselves thin at some point, especially in an area of business. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Men, I have a specific line of thought for you real quick. You have spheres of your life that are important. Regardless of what you do to earn a living, don't let your priorities change and lose sight of your goals. Primarily, your jobs are, you know, we use the four P's, the priest, prophet, provider, and protector. But in case there's any doubt, and I can attest to this from a lifetime of watching a dad who is a businessman and an entrepreneur, that your children will learn from your work ethic. They'll learn from your honoring of authority. They'll learn from how you spend your downtime. And they will learn when you apply yourself and what you consider to be success. They may not have the same gifts and skills as you. So be aware that if God has given them an ability to do woodworking and you're not a woodworker, they may be doing things that you can't teach them. And you may only be able to facilitate that. And that's good. That's okay. Because now they're using a gift that God has given them. And they can grow and they can do things. And you can just shepherd them and help point them in more principial ways than in actual teaching of how to do it. But that's a blessing. So don't template what they're doing. I think there's a real fine line between legacy and family business and family businesses that imprison multiple generations. It's a really dangerous thing to say at a Reformed church conference and everything because we love multi-generational business and faith, you know. But seriously, there are I have some close friends who are sort of trapped in these multi-generational businesses because their parents are so sure that their kid needs to do exactly what they did and continue it, that the children are trapped and have no way to use this other thing that God has clearly gifted them in. And I think that that's an extreme case, but it's something we need to be aware of. So teach your homes how to work. Teach them to love hard work. And teach them to go after what God has given them to do, whatever that is. If you don't know what it is, I don't know how many times, my dad was a man of many skills, but I don't know how many times he would buy us, you know, a model train magazine or a rocket kit or something, and he may never have done any of that before. But so he was trying to facilitate resources that would help us learn and grow. That means more than I can say. And I don't know how many times I have told my worldly coworkers, fellow Christians, I've told them about that kind of stuff. And it's like, that's what I want to do. I want to do that for my kids. So really, in closing, can we do much better than entrepreneurship? It doesn't need to be a startup, though our society is putting a lot of pressure into the success and failure of small business ventures. Ignore the noise, ignore the pomp and circumstance surrounding shows like Silicon Valley and stuff. Don't be discouraged by the numbers. Don't be discouraged by humble means. And don't be discouraged by small successes. I was just talking to someone last night about this, that God sees every ounce of strength and rewards the hard work that you do, regardless of what it looks like. And regardless of how you measure it to someone else's success. Proverbs 14:23 says, in all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. I told you before, I was kind of redefining starving artist when I was first self-employed. And I can tell you that this verse is true. Because if you only talk about what you want to do, if you just make grand plans, then you will end up in poverty. But if you apply yourself to diligent labor and you do it with the principles that God has given us, then you will see a profit and people will notice. So remember that you can achieve the goals by the smallest measures. I mean, help a kid sell donut holes or work with those close to you on a group project, mow a lawn, draw a picture, walk a dog, whatever it is. Be a blessing to man and a steward of the world. And be faithful before God with the time and resources he's provided. So I want to exhort all of you to serve him through the sweat of your brow. And it will be the sweat of your brow. But in this, you turn that curse of sin on its ear. If you give every ounce of your being to glorifying God in everything you do, whether you eat, drink, or whatever you do, and you're a good steward with your God-honoring labor, then you have used the entrepreneurial spirit, the creative spirit that God has put in all of us to use the gifts he has given us and glorify him. And I believe that the key to God-honoring labor is stewardship, which is exactly why I can't give you hands-on advice or training. Only you know how much time and attention you can devote to work or what work you should do. But I do want to encourage you to keep your goals in focus. Keep the members of your home beside you, just like Nehemiah. and the gospel ever before you. But then and only then can you engage in biblical entrepreneurship.